Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Adam Ragusa. Meghna Chakrabarty is out today. This week, Lieutenant Governor Tim Murray faced further scrutiny for his relationship with the former head of the Chelsea Housing Authority, Michael McLaughlin, after it was reported that McLaughlin may have raised money inappropriately for Murray.
He was never asked by me or anyone in my organization to solicit donations.
Also this week, Governor Patrick unveiled his 2012 agenda in his annual State of the State.
There are parents across our state who wonder tonight whether they will be able to do as well for their children as their parents did for them.
And for the second time in as many weeks, Newton was rocked by child pornography charges against a public worker.
My son, you know, really trusts teachers. I'm having a hard time trying to explain to him how to really trust teachers because this man has now broken trust for all teachers, I believe.
Well, joining us now to review the week's news, the big stories, are two members of our Week in Review panel. Joan Vinocchi, columnist for the Boston Globe. Hi, Joan. Great to have you.
Hi. Nice to be back.
And Kyle Chaney, reporter with the State House News Service. Kyle, great to have you as well.
Hi there. Good to be back.
Well, let's start with that story about Lieutenant Governor Tim Murray. The Boston Globe investigated Tim Murray's relationship this week with the embattled former head of the Chelsea Housing Authority, Michael McLaughlin. McLaughlin resigned under pressure after we learned he was earning $360,000 a year, more than the state says he was reporting. The Globe showed that McLaughlin was raising money for Murray and that he might have been violating campaign finance laws. Here's how Lieutenant Governor Murray responded this week.
I find the allegations very troubling, and he was not asked or authorized to do that. And we want to get to the bottom of it so that we can get the situation rectified. And if any of these allegations are true, the money returned.
So Murray was already being forced to explain away that bizarre car crash that he was lucky to survive. Now this. What do we make of this story? Let me start with you, Joan.
Well, he's got a whole lot of explaining to do.
Even more.
It doesn't seem to go away. Ouch. You know, the story pretty well documented that, you know, there was fundraising going on. McLaughlin introduced Tim Murray at a couple of fundraisers. There were calls between Murray's fundraiser and McLaughlin, yet the lieutenant governor says that he had no idea that there was fundraising going on. He's got a lot of explaining to do.
And Kyle, we knew that McLaughlin and Murray were close before this. Was it a surprise to find out that McLaughlin was raising money for Murray? And what's your response?
Well, it's hard to say whether it was a surprise that he was fundraising for him. We knew they were close. We knew the Globe had pretty well documented just how many phone conversations the two had with each other, hundreds in recent years. And so the fact is the two communicated on a fairly regular basis. The question, though, is whether Murray was as genuinely betrayed by McLaughlin as he claimed to be. I think the governor went on the radio this week and defended Murray and said, you know, listen, the lieutenant governor, first of all, is a fantastic guy and had no clue what was going on and really felt betrayed by him.
Well, actually, I'm glad you mentioned the governor. We've got two pieces of tape here to play, and it's really interesting. Here's Governor Patrick. Here's what he said back in November about Murray's association with McLaughlin after the Globe revealed that he exchanged scores of phone calls with him. Let's listen.
I do not believe in guilt by association. This is a fabulous lieutenant governor.
A fabulous lieutenant governor. And here he is the week after that fundraising story came out.
This is a fabulous lieutenant governor. He feels betrayed by this character, and I think that is something we all feel.
So a fabulous lieutenant governor, Joan Vinocchi. Patrick is not wavering in his support here. Did you see the lieutenant governor's issue becoming a liability for the governor?
Well, I think that it is getting to that point. But if it's true that Murray was betrayed and, you know, Deval Patrick is betrayed as well, they need to do a better job vetting people that they do business with. I don't mean from the fundraising standpoint, just about, you know, associating with. McLaughlin is, you know, a scoundrel. He's got a long history of, you know, political history in this state. And the lieutenant governor's answer is that, well, all that happened when he was in junior high school. I don't think that's a good answer for someone who was mayor, now the lieutenant governor, and really is Patrick's emissary mm-hmm. out there.
Well, and it, I think it's worth noting, too, that you know the governor, you know, the lieutenant governor is viewed by many as a potential candidate for governor in a couple of years, and I think that's why this whole scandal, all these questions around his relationship with McLaughlin have a lot of ramifications for his political future. And his credibility, you know, rightly or wrongly, has been called into question. So I think the governor sticking his neck out for the lieutenant governor is a pretty important vote of confidence for the lieutenant governor if he hopes to come out of this unscathed.
And I want to talk about that a little bit. And Joan, in fact, you wrote about this week. But let me just ask one more question about this Murray affair. He has since requested that the State Office of Campaign and Political Finance investigate the allegations around political fundraising. Sounds familiar to his request for a breathalyzer test after that car accident in November. Does it sound like a sincere effort to get to the truth or a little self-serving? What do you think, Joan?
Well, my colleague Scott Lehigh wrote a pretty funny column about, you know, what's he next going to ask an investigation of. He's you know, it's never a good thing when a politician has to ask either for a breathalyzer or for another state agency to investigate his behavior. And I don't know, I think it's his political future is a little bit cloudy at this point.
And speaking of that, and Kyle brought this up, Joan, you wrote this week, Joan, about the potential candidates for governor down the way. And you wrote this week, about the slim pickings, especially for Democrats. How do these recent developments affect Murray's possible run?
Well, leave it to a columnist to start, you know, talking about 2014 and 2012. Right?
Hey, it's never too soon.
I know it's never too soon.
We're already tired of 2012, right?
I was at the State of the State. I saw Kyle there, who's, you know, our intrepid reporter in the State House. And I saw the panoply of, you know, Murray, Martha Coakley, Steve Grossman, and Suzanne Bump, and started thinking about the next governor's race. And they are people that have been around for quite some time. And it, you know, it will be interesting to see how the next gubernatorial shakes down, and whether or not, you know, Charlie Baker, who ran unsuccessfully against Deval Patrick the last time out, you know, gears up and makes another run.
Hmm. And Kyle, what do you see out there? Any other possible candidates that we should be considering?
Oh, I think the one candidate we should be considering is probably the one that nobody's thought of yet. It's really, I think what Joan says is right, is that those who have been eyed are the ones who people are very familiar with, been around, their veterans, and whatever the case, whoever it ends up being, it's going to be a very different race to cover than it is watching, you know, Deval Patrick and Charlie Baker go at it, different people all around.
Well, let's move on to another big story this week. Governor Deval Patrick gave his annual State of the State address.
The strength of our progress is an indisputable fact. Things are better in Massachusetts than in most other places in America, but that does not mean they are good enough. We have hard choices yet to make.
And we'll talk a bit about some of those hard choices and some of Patrick's proposals. But first, a State of the State address, it's a time to take stock. How's Governor Deval Patrick doing at this point in his career as governor? And how's he doing in communicating his agenda to the public? Joan.
I think he's doing a better job communicating his agenda about, you know, President Obama than he is necessarily communicating his agenda about Massachusetts. I mean, I thought you know, the speech was a fine speech. He got a huge reception. He got lots of applause. You know, the theater of those moments are always really interesting to watch. In the aftermath, the reaction was, I would say, tepid. I don't know what you think, Kyle.
Yeah, Kyle, I'd be curious to hear that.
I think tepid is a fair way to describe it. And I think, you know, the governor has hammered on the same themes for a long time now, which is that this Massachusetts is outperforming the rest of the country. The state is in recovery at a faster clip than its peers. But I think, you know, and I know we'll get to this, but, you know, he put out a budget a couple days later that showed that, you know, the state is still far from in a great position economically. And so I think that dampened some of the enthusiasm for his speech on Monday because people are facing this grim reality of what they're going to have to deal with in the upcoming budget season.
We'll talk a little bit about that, the budget and what folks are going to be dealing with when this talk and debate really gets underway.
Well, you know, there's been a huge wave of optimism because the state is going to start to see increased tax collections, which gets everyone wringing their hands about what can we start increasing? Can we start increasing these really favored programs? But at the same time, the state is absolutely crushed right now by these costs that just keep soaring for health care for low-income residents and collective bargaining costs and things that just grow constantly year after year, and it's going to swallow up any of these new taxes. So in reality, the numbers look like they're going in the right direction. The state's going to be looking at another year of cuts. The governor's proposed some small-scale tax increases. Really not a lot to brag about in terms of growing in this budget.
Well, in the State of the State address, he talked about education. Mm-hmm. He talked about health care. He also talked about crime. Mm-hmm. Here's the governor on the so-called three strikes bill now being considered on Beacon Hill. Patrick supports it, and if approved, it would remove the possibility of parole for some violent third-time offenders.
We cannot and will not pursue a strategy that categorically rejects the proper place of parole in public safety. But that small number of the most hardened and destructive offenders ought to be separated from the public for a long time.
Critics of the proposed three strikes bill were out in force this week. Here's Harvard Law Professor Charles Ogletree, who called it mean-spirited and said it would raise incarceration rates and costs.
People in California did the same thing, thinking they're going to be tough on crime. And now the Supreme Court has told them, either you let thousands of people go or we will.
So, Joan, let me come to you first about this. Always a bit of a balancing act, being tough on crime, but prison overcrowding is a real issue. So is the theme of compassion. Is the three strikes bill, does it find a balance? What's your view on that?
Well, I thought, you know, Governor Patrick was really trying to find that middle ground in the speech. And as I understand it, and Kyle, you know, jump in if I'm wrong on this, I thought that he, you know, was saying that he supports the three strikes bill with modifications mm-hmm. that narrow the list of, you know, crimes for which you would, you know, be consigned to prison forever. And I don't know that they've reached that, they've narrowed the list yet to his specifications.
Yeah, Kyle, can you sort of profile the debate that is to come? I mean, the debate's been going on. It'll continue up there on Beacon Hill.
No, absolutely. Right now, that bill is two bills going, one passed by the House, one passed by the Senate, that would crack down severely on people who commit their third serious felony. And one of the big debates is what crimes would make you eligible to face the maximum possible sentence if you're found guilty of a third felony. And I think the governor, again, did sort of position it in where he said, I'll accept that kind of crackdown, but you have to tailor that list of crimes so that it's not too sweeping. One criticism is people could get thrown in jail for life or 25 years for breaking into a car, which they said, you know, it's a serious crime, but is it really 25 years minimum? And on the other end, the governor again positioned himself on saying, okay, we want to crack down, but then on the other end, we need to let out some of these nonviolent drug offenders who are being warehoused and they're coming out more dangerous than they went in. That's how he usually phrases it.
And there was a lot of – I'm sorry. Go ahead, Joan.
I was going to say it hasn't been tailored down yet.
So no, it hasn't. It's still being negotiated.
It's sort of an exit strategy for him if he doesn't get the list down to where he wants it, to say, well, look, I tried to make it happen, but it didn't.
Meanwhile, there was really vociferous, really impassioned criticism from some of Boston's black clergy. Members of the 10-Point Coalition were really critical of this bill, saying that it essentially is unfair to those communities. How much of an effect will that have on this debate, Kyle?
I think it'll have a huge effect on the debate. There's the biggest, the Patrick administration itself put out a report this week that said on our current trajectory, our prisons, they're already at like 150% overcrowded, and it's going to require us to build new prisons just to stay on the track that we're on. And they're talking in the governor's budget about actually closing a prison. But I think the argument that cracking down on felons without something on the other end to relieve pressure on overcrowded jails is a forceful one, a powerful one this time.
Well,
it's a real sea change for Governor Patrick to be, you know, promoting the so-called, you know, three strikes when you're out version mm-hmm. of you know, justice for Massachusetts.
It does feel like a bit of a time warp, I got to say, but a very interesting debate. And in fact, we're going to be focusing on it a little bit next week on Radio Boston. Finally this week, and this is a tough and unpleasant story and crime related, for the second time in as many weeks, a Newton public worker was arrested on child pornography charges. A part-time worker at the public library was arrested for possessing and distributing child pornography. Last week, it was a public school second grade teacher facing even graver child pornography charges. Here's Newton School Superintendent David Fleischman.
What else can we do in terms of background checks, professional training for staff? And we're really open to feedback. We're consulting with all kinds of experts to do whatever we can to make a difference.
So both of these men have no prior record. And in fact, Newton ran a Corey background check last year on the teacher. Nothing showed up. So it's really hard to know what could have been done. Not very reassuring. What do you make of this, Joan?
Well, not to, you know, be glib on such a serious topic, but I think part of, you know, the lesson from this is that bad things can happen even in Newton. And that our stereotypical thinking of where things like this happen and, you know, who are, you know, child pornographers or, you know, involved in pornography webs, that it's not always, it doesn't always fit the stereotype. And that's one thing that comes out of it, I think.
In the case of the teacher, Federal Justice Department and Homeland Security Department had been investigating him all the way back to 2010, but apparently didn't know he was a teacher. And for some unknown reason, he hadn't been picked up. Do you think someone should be held responsible for neglect, if nothing else, for not acting sooner? What do you think, Kyle?
It's hard to know what levers there were to pull, whether, you know what policymakers, especially who are ones that are going to be looking at this and saying, what could we have done to prevent this? It's hard to know what they could have pulled. You know, it sounds like this is, it's just a matter of, you know, there's always been criticisms of intelligence sharing among federal agencies and things like that. This seems like, you know, between criminal justice agencies, that it's the same kind of thing where if there had just been more talking to between state, local, and federal officials, this might have been prevented or exposed earlier. But, you know, it's hard to know whether there's really a magic bullet to prevent this kind of thing.
Sure, the magic bullet to connect those dots. Well, let's turn to our weekly hubbub, that story that didn't make it above the fold. And let me bring Adam back into this conversation. Adam, what's your hubbub today, this week?
My hubbub comes from my town of Cambridge, which, like Lowell, like Worcester, like other communities on the Plan E form of local government, has a mayor which is largely ceremonial, procedural in nature. Therefore, it is reassuring in light of that fact that we don't have one right now in Cambridge because, as you know, the Cambridge City Councilors elect the mayor from among themselves. And they all, over three consecutive ballots of these last 3 weeks, too many of them keep voting for themselves such that no one of them has been able to get a sufficient margin to become mayor.
Now, is that a case of political self-absorption? I mean, how do we characterize that?
I think it's hard to characterize it any other way, Anthony. That said, you know, I thought that was kind of funny when I read about it. But then upon looking into it further, and a lot of people have been kind of digging this around in the Cambridge blogosphere, this is in no way new. Happened in 2009. They had to ballot six times before they elected David Marmare. But 1948, the year 1948, the Cambridge City Council had to ballot 1,396 times before they were able to elect a mayor. They did it multiple times over the course of each meeting. It took them 4 months.
Well, they must have gotten good at it.
That's right.
Joan, let me come to you. Your hubbub this week.
Well, my hubbub comes from the obituary page, which may say something about my mood and or reading interests. But at any rate, in the New York Times, there was an obituary about Wesley Brown, the oldest active federal judge, who died at age 104 in Wichita, Kansas. The weeks leading up to his death, he was still working from his bedside, and he had been appointed by President Kennedy and profiled in 2010 by the New York Times on page one. And I just liked the idea that someone could work as long as he did and probably never tweeted.
That's amazing. That's a great one. Kyle, that leaves you. Your hubbub.
Yep. Well, the Massachusetts House of Representatives is you know, a pretty collegial body, and whenever they engage in debates on whatever the matters of the day are, if you watch them in session, they're often chatting away on their smartphones, tweeting live from the session. And this week, a freshman rep from Orange, her name is Denise Andrews, got up and decided she'd had enough and felt her colleagues weren't giving her the respect of paying attention to her when she was speaking. And she laced into them and said, you know, how can we solve the problems that are facing the people of Massachusetts if we can't even sit up here and listen to each other? And it was a rare breach of she believes their breach in decorum, but it was a rare slight at leadership for not keeping their house in order, and it's one that had a lot of members raising their eyebrows and some even applauding her in the aftermath.
I imagine that the people of Orange, Massachusetts are still smarting from that line in Friends of Eddie Coyle, in which Eddie remarks at the fact that he's lived in Massachusetts his entire life and had no idea there was a place called Orange.
That's great. Adam, I want to just come back to that number of times the Cambridge City Council voted in the last century. 1,000 what?
1,396.
Well,
it could get worse.
That's such a good story. I'm going to claim that as my hubbub this week as well. Joan Vanocki, columnist for the Boston Globe, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Kyle Chaney, reporter at the State House News Service. A pleasure as always, Kyle. Have a great weekend.
Thanks very much. You too.
Stay with us. Coming up, Rick Santorum had plenty to say about Mitt Romney and Massachusetts healthcare in last night's debate. But how much sticks? The Romney Care Truth Squad after a break. I'm Adam Ragusea.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.